This is Patty Krumholz for the Talking Information Center, reading from the February 15th, 2026 edition of the New York Times Magazine. First article, Period Drama by Paul McAdory. What are fans really searching for when they nitpick new adaptations for historical inaccuracies? Where is the obstacle? In a trailer for the new film adaptation of Wuthering Heights, Emily Bronte's 1847 Gothic novel about obsessive love and calamitous revenge in the moors of northern England, a servant puts this question to her distressed mistress, Catherine Earnshaw, played by Margot Robbie. Kathy, as she's known, has accepted an offer of marriage from her affluent neighbor despite, or because of, her love for Heathcliff, the mysterious orphan her family took in years prior, who became her childhood companion and has now grown into a ruggedly handsome young man. Tearful for the bargain she has made, Kathy presses her hand to her chest and replies with one word, here. Put the same question to the many early detractors of this adaptation directed by Emerald Fennell, and they might point not at their hearts but at everything that's on the screen. The sweeping romantic tone and sexual content of the promotional materials, which they see as an affront to the book. Elsewhere in the trailer, we glimpse shots of an elaborate dollhouse, bountiful table spreads and smothering fog, as well as a suggestively worked mound of dough, characters fondling a wall that appears to be made of flesh, and ecstatic gasps from Kathy at Heathcliff's touch. All of it rushes by to the beat of an electro ballad by the pop star Charlie XCX. It presents the film as an epic, explicit romance rendered like a contemporary high-concept fashion editorial. Online commenters have denounced it as 50 Shades of Bronte, Wine Mom Porn Slop, and a middle finger to the source material. In a Reddit thread about a teaser, a user lamented that, quote, Emily is rolling in her grave, end quote. Another wrote that it, quote, feels like some historically inaccurate, poorly written, cringy, questionable, and tasteless dark romance, end quote. This is not your great-great-great-grandmother's Wuthering Heights, and to these viewers, that is a problem. Something similar happened with the trailer for Christopher Nolan's upcoming adaptation of Homer's Odyssey, in which Matt Damon plays Odysseus. Quote, after years of war, no one could stand between my men and home, end quote, he sets up in a voiceover. Many viewers immediately took umbrage. The problems weren't about the familiar story beats that flip by, like the Cyclops entering his cave or dead warriors rising to face the living. The issue was historical accuracy. Dozens of videos, posts, and articles boasting millions of views object that the austere cuirasses, drab leather nonsense in one user's words, and red plumed helmets worn by Odysseus and his crew do not resemble actual Bronze Age Greek armor circa 1200 BC. The gray, Kevlar-like helmet we see atop Agamemnon's head, meanwhile, has been compared to a leftover prop from Nolan's Batman series and, like a toy helmet, that viewers fear will break the immersion. They also noticed that Nolan put Odysseus on a Viking-style boat rather than an ancient Greek pentaconter, and in some shots, substituted Scottish isles with their local flora for Mediterranean ones. That people enjoy complaining online about movies, especially ones they haven't seen, is hardly a revelation. Still, it's a little surprising after a century plus of book-to-screen adaptations, including dozens of Wuthering Heights films and series, and given the glut of adapted content, remakes, and reboots pumped out by studios and streamers, that some still want new adaptations of canonical works to be dutiful retreads of their source material or history lessons in movie form. The Wuthering Heights trailer describes the film as inspired by the book. There are even telling quotation marks around the title, and Fennell herself has said her adaptation was inspired by the emotions unleashed by her first encounter with the novel at age 14. But this makes little difference to these purists. The book is sacred, and deviations from it amount to violations. Kathy should be a brunette teenager, not a mid-30s blonde. Heathcliff should be racially ambiguous, whereas the actor playing him, Jacob Elordi, is merely partly Basque. A haunted, febrile tale of quashed desire and ruinous violence should not be billed as the greatest love story of all time, as the trailer has it, nor should it look like, quote, a smutified version of Wuthering Heights, end quote, as a YouTuber says in a video titled Why Margot Robbie is So Wrong for Wuthering Heights. Movies that have failed to replicate their sources have maddened viewers and authors alike for decades. Some Stephen King readers, like the author himself, hated Stanley Kubrick's 1980 adaptation of The Shining. Fans have cataloged disdained and celebrated the differences between J.R.R. Tolkien's books and their various adaptations. More recently, Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein effort drew criticism for its unfaithfulness to Mary Shelley's novel. But social media and streaming video have enabled and incentivized a new degree of online pedantry and nitpicking. Netflix and its ilk strip mining existing works for content. When they do produce something nominally new, it's often edited, shot, and lit like the rest of their library. We are subjected to the same stories with the same aesthetics again and again, and we are dazed by the monotony. On YouTube and TikTok, meanwhile, trailer breakdowns scrutinize every frame of movies and their advertisements for hidden meanings and Easter eggs. This situation has inspired among select viewers a form of spectatorship that resembles the way you might compare values across spreadsheets, a kind of anxious professional monitoring in which the images on screen must be checked and rechecked for their accordance with the original text and pre-existing notions about it. Just as every new rendition of an old work is said to reflect contemporary concerns, to tell us something about where we are now, this mode of spectatorship might clue us in to how we see and fail to see our own overwhelmingly complicated world. Looking to canonical texts for something unchanging, as well as for representation of a more concrete, ostensibly simpler past, however fantastical or realistic, might imply a certain queasiness or instability in our relation to the present. When it's impossible to know where we're headed, the supposedly determined facts of the past can be a comfort. Odysseus may have had a rough go of it, but we know how his story ends. If we feel incapable of changing the course of current events, we can turn, at least, to our screens to express our nagging sense that there is something wrong in the world, something to be uncovered, and if not set right, then at least critiqued. Never mind that the original works will remain unaffected by these latest films and that additional adaptations will be made, nor that one of the purposes of narrative art is to mold life into a new object that offers an invigorating perspective on our world. Hollywood is plenty capable of churning out insipid, numbing content, but a funereal reverence for source material can produce boring results too. The texts themselves, of course, are not as stable as we might like to believe. Reading a new translation of The Odyssey or rereading Wuthering Heights or Frankenstein, I tend to discover both how little I remember of the particulars of the stories and how much my responses to individual passages can evolve. We might as well embrace the inevitable changes in our relationships to the canon and reserve our displeasure for the bland, patronizing interpretations of today, forgiving those that aspire to genuine difference or real artistry. We might as well relish the opportunity for some kind of discovery. Better to return to the texts and to give daring adaptations their fair shake than to live like Heathcliff, cantankerous and volatile, hoping to coax a ghost of the half-remembered past back into our hearts. End of article. Next article, A Fragmented Self by Maggie Jones. From the time she was a child, Melissa Kaufman felt as if she had a gang of kids in her mind, each with their own thoughts and opinions. One was a girl who was curious and wanted to learn. Another was calm, wise, and confident enough to speak in class. Though she was only a few years older than the rest, Kaufman thought of her as the nice lady. Then there was the angry boy who was tough and unafraid. And at the far back of her mind existed a very young girl. All alone behind a door and in a box, she cried and screamed. The curious girl, the nice lady, and the angry boy avoided her, frightened by the pain and the secrets she held. Until Kaufman was about 10 years old, these inside people seemed like her friends. But by middle school, the angry boy who wanted to play, not study, argued with the others. He disliked them, declaring that some were dirty and weak. In Kaufman's mind, she saw them as stick figures, but sometimes they felt more three-dimensional, which scared her. She also began to realize that none of her friends had people in their heads, decided she would make the inside people go away by her 14th birthday. When they didn't, she vowed it would happen by her 15th, then by her 16th. Kaufman hated looking in the mirror. She still avoids it. She felt something was unsafe about existing in a female body. When she tried on clothes in a store, It was as if a thick fog descended over her, and the boy surfaced to express revulsion at what she was wearing at her body. Other times, he was furious at the crying girl in the box and wanted her to disappear. The nice lady and others tried to shush him. So many voices, so many opinions, all of which overwhelmed her. The experiences also confounded Kaufman. She had been abused and neglected as a child, but she didn't make a connection to what was happening inside her. And as distraught as she felt, no one else seemed to notice. She had plenty of friends and was smart. She could also tell that her voices existed only inside her mind, unlike people with schizophrenia who hear voices that they perceive as external. By college, she repeatedly had flashbacks to the abuse and grew increasingly depressed. Occasionally, when she was on a date with a guy at a party, she would leave him without saying goodbye. She couldn't explain why she did it. Sometimes, she didn't remember getting home. It would take decades for her to understand that the feeling of having multiple people inside herself and the amnesia she sometimes experienced were signs of an extreme type of dissociation known as dissociative identity disorder, or DID, a psychological defense mechanism that many experts believe develops in the wake of repeated childhood abuse or serious ongoing neglect. Since 1994, DID has been included in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the most widely used guide on mental health issues. Before then, it was known as multiple personality disorder. A misnomer, because rather than having numerous personalities, people with the disorder have one personality with compartmentalized aspects of themselves, known as self-states, or what some people call parts or alters. About 1% of the U.S. population is thought to have the disorder, according to the DSM, making it about as common as schizophrenia. Researchers have documented it in the Netherlands, Turkey, China, and other countries. It is also one of the most controversial diagnoses in psychiatry. For decades, some critics have argued that it is extremely rare or that it doesn't exist at all. The public's knowledge about the disorder tends to be informed by overdramatized and sometimes violent portrayals in movies like Sybil and Split. More recently, on TikTok, where one account focused on DID has about 1 million followers, some people displayed the disorder floridly, as well as in other ways that don't align with many experts' clinical experiences. Even as TikTok portrayals have renewed skepticism among critics, the field of psychiatry has never had more robust scientific and clinical data about the disorder, including the ways it defies decades-old stereotypes. There are now multiple validated assessment tools for dissociative disorders, including DID, as well as neuroimaging studies that show how severe dissociation manifests in the brain. Kaufman has played a role in this burgeoning understanding. Spurred by her own condition, she became a psychiatrist and has devoted her career to research and treatment for dissociation and trauma. For 16 years, she has been the medical director of several trauma programs at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, and co-director of its Dissociative Disorders and Trauma Research Program. She also helped found a McLean Advisory Committee through which people with DID educate medical students, residents, and researchers about living with the disorder. Still, it wasn't until about our third conversation that she told me that she herself had DID in the past and had fully recovered from it after years of treatment. At the time, only a few colleagues knew. Quote, "It took me a long time to even be able to say I had the disorder in therapy," she told me one afternoon in a garden outside her office, referring to more than 2 decades ago when she sought help for her struggles. "I couldn't say the words I have DID until the end of my therapy," end quote. Now 60, with 2 teenage sons, Kaufman is shy and warm and known among her graduate students and colleagues as incisive and generous. Yet, as eager as she was to educate the public about the disorder, she had avoided sharing her experiences, she said, quote, "For layers and layers of reasons, including that I didn't want to think about my diagnosis. I had a lot of shame around it," end quote. She also feared that disclosing it could hurt her lab's funding, given the stigma around DID. And because she regularly assesses patients for various dissociative disorders, she worried critics might accuse her of overdiagnosing DID, even though, as she said, quote, "I have an ethical obligation to practice medicine according to the standards of care. I have no skin in the game about someone having a certain diagnosis," end quote. For weeks after she first told me, she contemplated the consequences of acknowledging it publicly. She talked to friends and colleagues, in many cases divulging it for the first time. Ultimately, she decided the risks were worth it, if her own story could elucidate the realities of the disorder. Quote, "My goal is to help people understand what it's like as a kid who lives with these symptoms, what it's like as an adult. It's not what many people imagine," end quote. Experts in trauma have long argued that DID is an ingenious survival tool born in childhood. It typically begins by the time a child is 5 or 6 as a response to repeated abuse, often by a caregiver. Before about 6 years old, children generally have not yet formed a coherent sense of self. They may have imaginary friends or displace their own thoughts or feelings onto stuffed animals. Quote, "My bunny is sad, he hates school," end quote. They may believe they will become a princess or Superman. It's all psychologically typical, and over time, most children develop a unified self. But for a small subset of abused children who have a capacity to dissociate, which experts theorize is in part genetic, developing a unified self becomes disrupted. To endure the physical and emotional pain, their mind makes it seem as if it is not happening to them but to someone else, someone inside them. Quote, "When it's too overwhelming to feel such fear, too dangerous to feel what is happening to their body, they feel like, that's not me," end quote, Kaufman says, noting that the phrase, me, not me, captures a core feeling for people living with DID. And because children frequently don't tell anyone about the abuse, the feeling of having inside people can be soothing. Often, people with DID unconsciously create an angry part as a protective mechanism, which tries to silence other parts that bring up traumatic memories. Many girls create boy parts, explains Richard Chaffetz, a psychiatrist who treats people with complex post-trauma and dissociative disorder, because they believe if they were male, the abuse would not have happened. Other parts, like Kaufman's nice lady who helped her speak in class, have certain skills that keep children engaged in school and in the larger world and help them experience humor, joy, hope. That's the adaptable aspect. But the flip side is that if a child has DID, their mind doesn't follow the usual developmental pathway to form a coherent self. Quote, "It's like a jigsaw puzzle where the pieces have never fully been put together," end quote, explains Richard Lowenstein, a pioneer in dissociative research and treatment and the founder of the trauma program at Shepherd Pratt, a psychiatric model center in Baltimore, medical center. While we all have self states, a work state, a social state, a family state, and so on, quote, "most people who are well integrated can move among their different parts," end quote, without feeling unstable, says Frank Putnam, an expert on child abuse and dissociative disorders and a professor of psychiatry at the University of North Carolina School for Medicine. Most people, too, experience some dissociation when they drive from the grocery store to home with little memory of how they got there, or they lose track of time while immersed in a video game. But for those with dissociative disorders, the experiences are more pervasive, intense, and disruptive. They may regularly feel disconnected from their thoughts, feelings, or bodily sensations, a psychological phenomenon known as depersonalization. They may also experience derealization, in which the world seems blurry, dreamlike, or unreal. People with DID have both, along with fragmented self states, which often cause them distress and can make daily functioning difficult. Among other things, one self state can be unaware of actions taken by another state. One therapist, for instance, told me about a client who once spilled coffee on his suit and then found himself in a new suit and didn't know how it happened. A woman told me she opened her car trunk one day to find 3 pairs of beautiful shoes in her size with no memory of buying them. Skepticism about DID stems in part from Sybil, published in 1973 and made into a TV movie 3 years later. Both were sensationalized versions of the story of Shirley Mason, a woman who her psychiatrist claimed had 16 personalities. Along with psychoanalysis, the therapist used hypnosis and injections of sodium pentothal, which may have created false memories of childhood abuse and personalities. An explosion of workshops followed to train therapists in multiple personality disorder, as it was then known. Some therapists asked clients leading questions and used hypnosis to uncover supposed sexual abuse and personalities, encouraging fabricated stories and memories. When used correctly, hypnosis is highly effective in helping ground people and quell anxiety, including for people with dissociative disorders. As cases of multiple personality disorder exploded, so did the criticism. Quote, "When I was seeing patients in the 1990s, It was so therapist-driven, end quote, says Alan Francis, professor emeritus of psychiatry at Duke University. Francis led the task force overseeing the revision of the fourth edition of the DSM, in which multiple personality disorder was renamed dissociative identity disorder. He counts himself among the psychiatrists who remain wary of the diagnosis, most recently because social media has, he says, propelled a surge in questionable self-diagnosis. For some people, Francis notes, DID provides a label for explaining their distress. Others believe they have it, he adds, because they are fantasy-prone and struggle to differentiate reality from their imagination. Stephen Sharfstein, a past president of the American Psychiatric Association, partly attributes ongoing skepticism about DID to the fact that while childhood abuse is widespread, at least 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 20 boys in the United States experience sexual abuse, mostly by people they know, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Psychiatrists disagree on the extent to which trauma is at the root of mental illnesses, including DID. Also, Sharfstein notes, the disorder can simply seem unfathomable. Quote, fragmented states challenge our assumptions about a unified self. It seems incredible that someone could have radically different states of minds when it's not a hallucination, not psychosis. And that's scary, including to some therapists who don't know how to treat it, end quote. But in contrast to the 1980s and 1990s, neuroscientists now have more clues about how severe dissociation appears in the brain. In the late 1990s, Ruth Lanius, a psychiatrist and neuroscientist who is the director of the PTSD Research Unit at the University of Western Ontario, was running a PTSD study using a standard approach for measuring responses to trauma memories. A person narrates a memory which is recorded and then played back during an fMRI scan. Typically, the subject's heart rate, blood pressure, and activity in their amygdala, which facilitates the fear response, increases. One subject had been so horrifically abused as a child that Lanius expected that narrated memory would trigger a flashback and the woman would feel as if she were reliving her trauma, causing her heart rate to spike. Instead, to Lanius's surprise, as the woman lay in the scanner, her heart rate dropped. Lanius had her listen to her trauma narrative 2 more times with the same result. When she interviewed the woman afterward, the subject said she felt numb and completely disconnected from her body. In further studies, Lanius was able to pinpoint areas of the brain that suggest subjects like her have a dissociative subtype of PTSD. In response to trauma, their brains, unlike classic PTSD patients, blunt arousal. Activity in their amygdala decreases, while processing in a part of the frontal lobe where emotions are controlled increases. More recently, Simone Reinders, a neuroscientist at King's College in London, has published multiple imaging studies about DID, including those in which actors were told to mimic different dissociative states. The actors could not match the neural responses of those diagnosed with DID. Critics have noted that some imaging studies have small sample sizes and should include PTSD subjects as controls. Newer studies, including by Kaufman and her colleague Lauren Lebois, show that patterns of brain network communication change depending on the severity of the dissociation. Quote, we don't yet have a singular biomarker for DID, Kaufman says, noting that schizophrenia and other disorders don't either. But we are seeing important patterns emerge. When she was 17 and in college, away from her friends and family, Kaufman felt unmoored. She started therapy, but couldn't talk about what was going on inside her. She'd never told friends or family members about the neglect and abuse she experienced as a child. She declined to discuss the specifics of her childhood trauma with me. She couldn't even fully acknowledge it to herself. For years, she'd been reading Sigmund Freud, Pierre Janet, and other psychologists who wrote about trauma and dissociation. Still, she could not make a conscious connection between what happened in childhood to her ongoing struggles, which were mostly easy to hide. Despite a couple of bouts of serious depression and anxiety, she was extremely high-functioning. Working hard in school was one of her coping mechanisms. In contrast, many people with the disorder also suffer from other mental health issues like substance abuse, eating disorders, debilitating anxiety and depression, and suicidal ideation. Over 70% of people with DID have attempted suicide, which sometimes are so severe they land patients in hospitals and make healing from the disorder harder. Several of the more than 2 dozen people I interviewed who have been diagnosed with DID had been in and out of hospitals or intensive outpatient programs, including a woman in her mid-30s who asked me to identify her by the first initial of her middle name, E, to protect her privacy. We met one summer afternoon not far from where she lives. Though initially cautious about talking to me, she was warm, funny, and insightful. As far back as she could remember, she had different parts of her mind. One part helped her focus in school, where she was an A student. Another was more social. Another extremely critical. Her favorite part was a teenager who took risks and pushed boundaries. In middle school, E wore her hair in a mop of curls, dressed in muted tones, big baggy sweatpants. But every Friday, she straightened her hair, wore a t-shirt that clung to her ribs, and lots of makeup. It wasn't a decision, it just happened. Though she struggled with dissociation and disturbing memories in adolescence, a breaking point came during her freshman year of college. She was giving a presentation on the male gaze in a women's studies class, and as she spoke, she had a flashback to sexual abuse from her childhood. She felt outside her own body, as if watching herself from afar. She froze in front of the class. That summer, she had to interact with people who had abused her, and her anxiety, depression, and OCD spiraled. She avoided touching food and developed elaborate hand-washing rituals. She started exercising compulsively and restricted what she ate. Inside her head, negative parts made her feel worthless and encouraged her to hurt herself. She lost 40 pounds over 3 months without being fully conscious of it. She drank too much, took too many benzodiazepines, and descended into a fog. Over the next years, E was hospitalized more than 24 times by her count, mostly for anorexia and suicidal ideation. She went in and out of attending school and work. During her first hospitalization, an intake staff member asked her if she had any history of trauma. E hated thinking about her past, much less talking about it. She said no. Later, a psychiatrist placed her on a trauma unit, where she was diagnosed with PTSD with a dissociative disorder. During a subsequent hospitalization, she received a diagnosis of DID. Another woman I met, S, the first letter of her middle name, told me that during her early stages of treatment, she struggled to navigate her job as a faculty member. Her hospitalizations and different self-states interfered with work. Sometimes, when she was grading students' papers, she couldn't make out the words, as if she were a child who couldn't read. Then one day, she was in a departmental meeting, and a dean asked S to explain something related to her work. In her mind, S felt like a young girl. She suspects something triggered her, and she suddenly believed she wasn't good enough or smart enough, a common experience when she was a child. But when she looked down at herself, her body didn't match. She was an adult wearing slacks and leather boots, the clothes of a professional. How, she thought, is it possible that anyone thinks I have something to say about this? For S, like for many people with DID, finding effective therapy took years. In one study, 1/3 of people with dissociative disorders reported struggling to find trained therapists. And people with DID often receive several misdiagnoses, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, borderline personality disorder, and are given medications that don't treat the disorder and may cause harm. There's no medication that specifically addresses dissociative disorders. Quote, I can't count the number of cases when someone with DID is diagnosed with schizophrenia, end quote, says Bethany Brand, professor emeritus of psychology at Towson University in Maryland, who is a clinician and the author of numerous studies on dissociative disorders. One of her patients, she says, was diagnosed with schizophrenia when she was a teenager, and it took decades before a therapist fully pinpointed that she had DID instead. Quote, imagine if they had cancer, but it was diagnosed as heart failure, end quote, she says. Part of the problem is that dissociation has long taken a backseat in psychology training. In a study of graduate psychopathology textbooks, Brand found that some of the books didn't address DID and other dissociative disorders in depth. Chaffetz told me that even if therapists recognize DID, they don't necessarily know how best to help the person, which starts with creating a, quote, solid, safe enough relationship, end quote, he says. Instead, some push clients to dig up traumatic memories too soon, or they become seduced by what they see as the dramatic elements of DID. Quote, how many personalities, he says, is exciting to some people, end quote. Starting in 2021, Kaufman and her colleagues around the country began hearing from an increasing number of families whose adolescents believed they had DID. McLean and other treatment centers also got calls from pediatricians and therapists asking for advice on how to assess teenagers reporting DID. It was during COVID. Kids were stuck at home, and TikTok videos about DID were growing in popularity. By 2022, videos with the hashtag DID had been viewed at least 2.7 billion times, and those with hashtag dissociative identity disorder, 1.5 billion times. TikTok no longer publishes information on views per hashtag. While some posts are educational, others show people abruptly switching self-states on camera, changing clothes, hairstyles, and voices, seemingly at will. As therapists and many people with DID explained to me, switching is typically involuntary and is often so internal that it's not obvious that someone is doing it. A person's eyes, voice, or posture may shift. On occasion, it can be more intense. A person regresses to a childlike state or looks as if they are having a panic attack. It's impossible to know how many people on TikTok have DID. There is likely to be a mix of those who actually have the disorder, those who pretend to have it, and those who believe they have it but don't. Several people diagnosed with DID told me they don't recognize their experiences in the TikTok videos they've seen. After a lifetime of shame about their abuse, children often believe it's their fault if an adult hurts them, and stigma surrounding the diagnosis, the idea of going public with their disorder feels incomprehensible. Quote, "I worry people think that's what it really looks like," E told me, "as if I am 60 different individuals in a body rather than one person," end quote. Self-diagnosing mental health issues via social media is hardly confined to DID, but experts worry that if people falsely claim to have DID, it will renew skepticism about the disorder. In addition, inexperienced therapists who rely on TikTok for their understanding of the disorder may miss real cases of DID. About a year ago, one teenager on TikTok disavowed his previous claim that he had DID. During COVID, he explained, he felt lonely and suffered from anxiety and depression and was looking for community and attention, the very things teenagers so often long for. On Discord, he found a group of teens with dissociative disorders, and over time he came to believe he had DID, with hundreds of parts. In response to his confession, many people commented that they had a similar experience. They thought they had DID, but it turned out that they had autism, bipolar disorder, psychosis. A few experts told me that some teenagers maybe experience a kind of social contagion, which happened with Tourette's syndrome during the early months of COVID, when TikTok videos about Tourette's escalated. Typically, the syndrome affects young boys, but in 2021, adolescent girls who were often struggling with other mental health issues like self-harm increasingly reported having Tourette's. But their tics didn't quite line up with typical Tourette's tics and instead reflected those in TikTok videos. The creator of what may be the largest DID TikTok account, The A System, with almost 1 million followers, told me that a therapist diagnosed them with the disorder several years ago. Posting on social media, they said, is an attempt to accept and embrace their disorder, and it's also how they found an understanding and accepting community. When we talked, they asked me to refer to them as Asher, their self-state at the time. They also asked that I not use their last name. They received regular hate messages, many accusing them of faking DID. Many of their videos, said Asher, who is in their 30s, do not reflect their life with DID. Some, they said, are purposefully dramatized while with two identities talking in conversation, one denying they have DID, the other not, often with different voiceovers and switching hats, outfits, or wigs for different self-states. The idea, they said, is to show what it feels like to them to live with DID. Quote, "I'm not an educator. I'm just trying to explain my own experience," end quote. Jamie Pollock, who was diagnosed with DID about 20 years ago and is the founder of Infinite Mind, an education advocacy group that hosts an annual conference for people with dissociative disorders, chalks up the post to a generational shift in which mental health problems are more accepted and being public about one's personal life is common. Quote, "I've talked to some of them who said they make their parts more distinct because it makes better content," Pollock says. "People are trying to break the stigma. DID doesn't look the same for everyone," end quote. After her diagnosis, Emma Sunshaw, a psychotherapist, an author, and the host of the widely respected DID podcast System Speak, found social media useful for a while. When Sunshaw was struggling to find a trained therapist, she discovered people on YouTube who talked about their experiences in a way that felt familiar and gave her a vocabulary to understand her own diagnosis. One study found YouTube videos are more accurate depictions of DID than TikTok. In other ways, though, she couldn't relate to them. Quote, "The videos were mostly about how people presented their states to the world," she told me. "People weren't talking about getting better," end quote, which Sunshaw desperately wanted to do. After Kaufman decided in college that she wanted to become a psychiatrist, she went on to get a PhD and an MD from Boston University. When she began her psychiatry residency, faculty encouraged the trainees to be in therapy to better understand their patients' perspectives. Kaufman started seeing a psychiatrist with an expertise in trauma disorders. Still, she couldn't talk about abuse in her childhood. She barely talked about her past at all and repeatedly told her therapist that she never felt angry. But over time, as she began to feel safer, Kaufman mentioned that she had different voices in her head and described some of the amnesia she experienced. Slowly, her therapist helped Kaufman understand that those voices represented difficult emotions that were too scary to process as a child. She explained that despite Kaufman's disavowing, feeling angry and vulnerable, the angry boy was Kaufman's own expression of anger and important to her survival. He served as a form of self-protection, in part by trying to push away self-states that held on to experiences of the past. And though her therapist acknowledged Kaufman's different self-states, she didn't reify them by writing down their names or speaking to a young state as if Kaufman herself was a child. Quote, "The parts were not the point, really," as Kaufman explained. "It was about the conflict represented by my self-states," end quote. During treatment, she read and reread the memoir, A Fractured Mind, My Life with Multiple Personality Disorder, by Robert Oxnam, a China scholar who was the president of the Asia Society in New York City for years and died in 2024. Kaufman was reassured by the fact that he was professionally successful and had a family. Knowing there were people with similar struggles, Kaufman says, came at, quote, "an important time in my own treatment," end quote. Still, when her psychiatrist diagnosed Kaufman with DID, she felt ashamed and panicked. Quote, "It's sort of akin to people who are so closeted," Kaufman, who is gay, told me, "that they don't even know they are gay," end quote. Therapy was slow and could be rocky. While driving to a session in one morning, a couple of Kaufman's scared young states wanted to talk to her therapist about the past, but her angry self-state, which helped keep her from thinking about the abuse, was furious, unwilling to do it. It felt like a war inside of her. She parked her car and, in her angry state, slammed the door, signed a check for the session, added a note that said she couldn't meet that day, and dropped it at the office. By the time Kaufman arrived at work, she was calm and professional and proceeded through her day as if nothing had happened. Not long after, when Kaufman cried during a session, she told her therapist it felt as if she was the young, neglected parts of herself that were crying. And as she started to acknowledge her traumatic experiences and dissociate less, she understood she was no longer at risk of abuse as she was as a child. She began to see, too, that her self-states were not separate. They were all aspects of herself. Then one day, after years of treatment, Kaufman noticed that the nice lady had disappeared. And next, the angry boy, quote, "He just lost steam," end quote, she told me. None of it was dramatic. One woman told me that when her parts quieted and finally became silent, it was like watching large inflatable yard decorations deflate. Quote, "They had nothing to do anymore," end quote, she said, referring to the roles they had protecting her and hiding secrets. On occasion, Kaufman misses some of her parts. She hates public speaking, and the first time she had to address an audience after the self-states disappeared, she wished she had the nice lady to do it. And she's still uncomfortable expressing anger in a way the angry part was not. Kaufman's own experience is what's known as integration. Many people won't get to that point, and it's often not a goal for them and their therapists. Instead, researchers are focused on other treatment outcomes for people with DID or other trauma-related dissociative disorders to create a standard of care for practitioners. In a recent study by Bethany Brand, therapists helped stabilize patients, among other interventions, and taught them to use strategies instead of dissociation to manage memories of trauma. The study found that subjects receiving the treatment hurt themselves less and experienced greater emotional regulation, self-compassion, and better relationships. Researchers in Britain, Denmark, Chile, and other countries are now developing studies using the same program. Even as they heal from DID, some people don't want to lose their parts. One evening at E's apartment, she told me that she was crying and distraught in therapy that day, recalling an old memory. Then, a part took over. She didn't summon it, but it washed over her, and she stopped crying immediately. Quote, "It's as if I took a Xanax," end quote. If she integrated, she wondered if the part would recede or disappear altogether. Would she no longer be able to get into a trance state that blocks out all distractions and had helped her be a focused student? Her ability to move into severe dissociation, she said, allows her to experience no pain during certain situations like getting a Brazilian wax. Often, people with DID have such intense depersonalization, feeling disconnected from their body, that they are unaware of their pain, even when they harm or cut themselves deeply. Quote, "In some ways, being totally integrated sounds super lonely at this point," S told me. "If you were to ask me what my real goal is, it wouldn't be to be integrated," end quote. Instead, for S, who is far more aware of her self-states than in the past, healing means improved self-regulation, including among her parts. Quote, right now, it's still as if there are lots of doors opening and closing in my mind with parts waking up at different times and creating chaos, end quote. At a DoubleTree Hotel in Orlando on the edge of SeaWorld, among multiple pools and waterfalls and all-you-can-eat breakfast, about 350 people gathered at a conference center tucked away in the back of the hotel grounds. They were there for Healing Together, the annual event Jamie Pollock created more than 15 years ago for people living with DID and other dissociative disorders, as well as their loved ones and clinicians in the field. Kaufman had told me about the conference and encouraged me to attend, calling it revolutionary for bringing people together with DID, who often feel there is no one else like them, and for focusing on education and support. In the main hallway, which was lined with tables, a therapist named Jamie Marich promoted her book, Dissociation Made Simple, and included bookmarks that proclaimed, dissociation is not a dirty word. Another tabletop was filled with ribbons to attach to name tags with playful messages of pride. Hashtag plurals, hot mess express, allow me to introduce myself. People had come from all over the United States and other countries to attend, some scraping together money to do so. Another 300 people attended online. One woman told me she was diagnosed more than a decade ago but was too scared to come to the conference before now. She brought her husband for moral support, the only other person aside from her therapist who knew she had DID. The conference was comforting and validating, she said. Quote, you come here and you can't deny your diagnosis anymore. I'm overwhelmed with feeling like I belong. End quote. A woman named Jennifer, who was a lawyer at a major international bank, attended her first conference more than a decade ago when she'd never met a person with DID. Robert Oxnam was among the speakers, and when Jennifer confided some of her struggles to him, he reassured her it would get better. And slowly it did. After years of therapy, she no longer has distinct self-states. She returned to the conference, she told me, hoping she could help others, just as Oxnam helped her. Every year, Pollock closes the conference by appearing on stage wearing a bee costume, a yellow tutu, a black and yellow striped jacket, and antennas. As a kid, she tells the audience, she didn't know anyone who had a mind like hers, who felt the way she did. Later in her life, Pollock attended groups for sex abuse survivors. They were useful, but she still felt like an outsider with a secret she couldn't share. Quote, I could never find my people, end quote, she says, until she created Healing Together. She then plays a video of Blind Melon's No Rain, which made her feel less alone in high school. In the video, an elementary school-aged girl, chubby and wearing glasses, is dressed in a yellow and black bee costume with a beanie on her head. Onlookers laugh at her or view her with puzzlement or indifference until she finds a field with dozens of people dancing and cartwheeling, twirling, jumping. All of them are dressed in yellow and black tutus, leotards, and beanies, just like her. The year I was there, Kaufman was ill and could not attend. She told me that when she first came to Healing Together more than a decade ago as a clinician and researcher, people kept approaching her. They were desperate for therapy referrals. They needed help with insurance problems. A woman asked if Kaufman could put her in an fMRI machine to prove to insurers that she had DID. No imaging scan can do that. Kaufman suggested clinicians and helped where she could. At the end of that weekend years ago, Kaufman went to the final event. As Pollock stood on stage and the video played, she invited her bees to stand up. Quote, I consider you, all of you, part of my beehive, end quote, she said. Kaufman watched as dozens of people crowded into the aisles and along the sides and back walls, some holding hands, other putting their arms around each other, all counting themselves among a community of people with the disorder. Kaufman couldn't bring herself to join them. She worried about her job and what her colleagues would think. She felt like a hypocrite, hiding behind the title of researcher, never divulging that she had lived with the disorder. She stayed in her seat, tears streaming down her face, both moved by the courage of others and ashamed of herself. She continued to return to the conference each year with her research team, who still didn't know she once had DID. Then, about 8 years ago, something shifted in her. Kaufman was sitting by herself during the closing ceremony when Pollock invited her bees to join her. This time, as people around her got up, some swaying together, Kaufman slowly rose from her seat. Her body felt heavy, her heart raced, part of her longed to sit back down. But as No Rain played, she remained standing. End of article. And the interview by David Marchese. Michael Pollan says humanity is about to undergo a revolutionary change. For as long as I can remember, I've wrestled with my own thoughts and feelings about identity. Why am I, David, the person I am? How changeable is that? Where do those thoughts and feelings come from anyway, and what purposes do they ultimately serve? I suppose it's no coincidence, then, that I've also always been so curious about the subject of human consciousness. That's the area of science and philosophy, of human thinking generally, that burrows most deeply into similar questions and, to varying degrees of satisfaction, offers a plethora of possible answers. The best-selling author Michael Pollan has been thinking about these things, too. Throughout his work, which includes classic books like The Omnivore's Dilemma, 2006, about why we eat the way we do, and How to Change Your Mind, 2018, about the science and uses of psychedelic drugs, Pollan has waded into ideas about the inner workings of the mind. Now, with his forthcoming book, A World Appears, A Journey into Consciousness, which will arrive this month, he has jumped into the deep end. The book is both a highly personal and expansive multidisciplinary survey of questions around human consciousness, what it is, what causes it, what it's for, and what the possible answers might mean for how we choose to live. And as Pollan explained, with the rise of artificial intelligence as well as the relentless political pressure on our attention, that is, our minds, those questions already profound are becoming only more urgent. Question. I want to get some basics. How do you define consciousness? Answer. The simplest way to define consciousness is as subjective experience. Another one-word definition is awareness. Thomas Nagel, the NYU philosopher, wrote a piece back in the 70s called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? His idea is, if we can imagine it is like anything to be a bat, then a bat is conscious because that means it has some sort of subjective experience. Why did he choose bats? Well, they're very different than we are. Instead of using eyesight, they use echolocation. They bounce signals off of objects to move through space. We can vaguely imagine going through the world with echolocation. Whereas my toaster, I can't do that. I don't have a sense of what it's like to be my toaster. Question. A big question of consciousness is what the philosopher David Chalmers has referred to as the hard problem. Can you tell people what that is? Answer. Basically, how can you get from matter to mind? How you cross that huge gulf from neurons to subjective experience? A gulf no one has managed to cross. Related questions are, why don't all these things we do go on automatically? Why do we have to be aware of anything? We could be completely automated and perhaps get along just fine. Your brain is monitoring your body and making fine adjustments in the blood gases, in the heart rate, in digestion. There's a lot going on that we don't have to think about. So why do we have to think about any of it? Some interesting theories have been proposed. One is that some of the issues that we deal with have to be decided in a conscious way. When you have two competing needs, you're hungry and you're tired, which should take precedence? So consciousness opens up this space of decision-making. The other argument is that we live in a very complex social world where I have to predict what you're going to say. I have to imagine my way into your head. You can't automate human social interaction. It has too many elements, so consciousness is very helpful in navigating that world. Question. I could happily talk about consciousness all day, but often when I do talk about it with people, I can tell that they view thinking about consciousness as almost akin to navel gazing. Like, it's an interesting thing to think about, but really, what difference does it make? What is your response to that? Answer. It's more important than ever. The big threat is artificial intelligence and the effort to create a conscious AI, which is going to be an enormous challenge to this question of what does it mean to be human? Is consciousness something that a machine can possess? Are we more like intelligent machines or conscious feeling animals? Who are we? So I think we're approaching this kind of Copernican moment of redefinition. Question. You are skeptical that AI can achieve consciousness. Why? Answer. I'm convinced by some of the researchers, including Antonio Damasio and Mark Solms, who made a really compelling case that the origin of consciousness is with feelings, not thoughts. Feelings are the language in which the body talks to the brain. We forget that brains exist to keep bodies alive, and the way the body gets the brain's attention is with feelings. So if you think feelings are at the center of consciousness, it's very hard to imagine how a machine could rise to that level to have feelings. The other reason I think we're not close to it is that everything that machines know, the data set on which they're trained, is information on the internet. They don't have friction with nature. They don't have friction with us. Some of the most important things we know are about person-to-person contact, about contact with nature, this friction that really makes us human. Question. Despite how it may seem, the internet is not actually the whole of the world. Answer. But to a computer, it's all you got. Question. How would we know if an AI is conscious or not? Answer. How do I know you're conscious? Question. I promise I am. answer. Your promise is what's called reportability in philosophy. You can ask something if it's conscious, and with humans, we kind of know. Question, but if an AI says, Michael, I'm conscious, I promise, how do we know? Answer, we don't, and that is exactly why people are falling deep into these relationships with AI. We can't say it's not conscious when it tells us it is, but we can test it in various ways. It all goes back to this idea of the Turing test, that the test of machine intelligence would be when they can fool us. Question, if the Turing test is the criteria for machine consciousness, then that test has already been passed. Answer, exactly. It has fooled many, many people. Whether it can fool an expert too, I don't know, but probably. So we're in a very weird place where the machines we're living with are telling us they're conscious. We can't dispute it, but we can look at how they're made and draw the kind of conclusions I've drawn. But is that going to persuade everybody? No, we want them to be conscious in some way, or some of us do. It's easier to have a relationship with a chatbot than another human. Going back to that friction point, they offer no friction. They just suck up to us and convince us how brilliant we are, and we fall for it. Question, what do you think religion has to offer to questions about consciousness? Answer, Buddhism has been thinking about consciousness for a very long time. It has been raising these questions about the self and giving people tools to transcend the self, which in itself is a desire that is surprising. We cling to this ego so firmly. At the same time, we do a lot of things to get away from it, whether it's extreme sports or psychedelics or meditation. Question, or watching a movie or having sex? Answer, some of the highest experiences of life are these moments where we transcend the self, and that's curious. Question, why, if we cling to the self, are we also so hungry to lose ourselves? Answer, the self isolates us. The ego builds walls around it. It's constantly evaluating. It ruminates. There's a lot of crappy stuff about the self. Question, yeah, it's constantly yammering away? Answer, yes, there is that voice in our head, and it embodies critical voices. I mean, the ego is very useful. It gets a lot done. It got my book done. It gets your podcast done. So we shouldn't be too critical of it. On the other hand, when we transcend the self, we connect to things larger than ourselves. And this is one of the beautiful things about psychedelics. When they work, there is this sense of dissolution of self. The wall comes down and you feel part of nature. You feel love. Question, how often do you do psychedelics? Answer, not very often at all. It's hard to find time. It's a big day with a lot of preparation and everything. If I can do it once a year, I'm happy. What I'm talking about is ideally a guided experience. You can let yourself go when someone's watching your body. Question, I brought something like this up earlier, but I want to ask another version of it. This morning, I was reading the news and thinking, gosh, right now, is talking to Michael Pollan about consciousness a kind of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin conversation? I decided the answer is no, but do you ever have those doubts? Answer, I did when I was starting on this book and the world was starting to fall apart. Like, is this how I should be using my energy? But I think that consciousness is at stake in a lot of what's going on. One of the things Trump has done is occupy a significant chunk of our attention every single day. Our consciousness is being polluted, and protecting ourselves against that at the same time we preserve the ability to act politically is a difficult balancing act. Consciousness is a very precious realm. It's the realm of our privacy and our freedom to think. So I think we need some kind of consciousness hygiene, particularly at this moment, where this one politician has figured out ways to command our attention. Consciousness is more relevant now than it even was 10 or 20 years ago as something to think about, protect, and nurture. End of article. And under letter of recommendation, Changing Your Number by Ronnie Scott. Changing my number had always been a street-level fantasy, the kind of thing I dream in my idle hours of doing because it seemed illicit, a thing you do on your first day on the job as a spy. It probably would have stayed that way, a never-realized fantasy, had a stranger not directly offered to realize it for me. My phone contract expired, and I had a busted screen, so I went into the store to get an upgrade. Here's a new SIM card, the employee told me. Can I transfer your number for you? I could have said yes. Instead, I chose to dream. I'd had the same number since I first got a cell phone at age 15, which means 25 years with the same string of numbers attached to my name. This persistence was not itself a liability. While I'm a little tech paranoid, as everybody should be, I was under no illusions that simply changing numbers would stymie surveillance by tech companies. Instead, I wanted to see how disconnecting from the number would or would not disturb my everyday world. Your phone number gives your mother, your plumber, and that hookup from 2013 strangely equal links to you. And each person who keeps your number generally does so on the basis that they might use it, a warrant that grows more unlikely as the years pass. In my case, the phone number was also on file at a dozen former rental properties, and every pizza store that had ever opened or closed in those properties' varied delivery zones. All those random people, all those random pizzas. Did they make up who I am? We all know that passports expire and email addresses change. Simple acts of wedlock are sometimes all it takes to obliterate a family name that has lasted for generations. By contrast, a phone number is treated as if it were inviolable. You can kick your phone's digits at any time. You don't even need to wait for an upgrade. Why weren't more people doing this? If so many were avoiding dropping dig, there had to be a shocking outcome I could not foresee, more serious than the logistical hassles. I needn't have worried. I experienced plenty of missteps, but none socially fatal. Once, I visited a friend at her office and found the door locked and the hallway empty because she had a migraine and had texted my old number to tell me. Then there was an encounter on a tram, the kind of loose acquaintance I might see once a year. We rode several stops together. He was obscurely hostile. It could have been anything, but I later realized he must have texted me and thought I was ghosting. If we had talked about it, I could have explained that ghosting, cleaved from its negative valence, is a pretty good word for the exhilarating experience of controlled reinvention that a new number allows. There is an organic grocery store on the other side of my suburb that asked me for my phone number to prove that I'm a member in order to get rotating discounts on refrigerator treats. It's a loyalty program in which you don't get points or birthday messages, just access to the sticker-advertised discounts. Once or twice I have reeled off the old digits, not having updated my account with the fresh ones. I could have been busted, those numbers no longer being mine. In the meantime, hadn't we continued to enjoy these frictionless purchases together? Wasn't the defunct number just a conventional point of ingress being used to access the real me? There's a glamour to the idea of a person who can take their life, scrunch it in a ball, toss it and move on, never again to think of whom or what they leave behind. There's also a darkness in which people have to endure brutal cycles of phoenix-like destruction and rebirth. I grew up knowing both kinds because I was an Air Force kid. Every few years, we would pack up, switch addresses, and get new area or even country codes. At these bases, I'd often meet grown-ups who dealt as best they could with their parents' protean qualities, focused on the benefits while dreaming of a life in which they might eventually put down roots. I also met hectic people who I'm not sure, if not still in the armed forces, are finding other reasons to keep the cycle of chaos rolling. Whether from wisdom, cowardice, or fortune, most of us, the lucky ones, I think, walk a line between the need for constancy and the need for change. This balance is not to be taken lightly. Without a level of staged upset, you might end up painting that kitchen a deep eggplant, adopting those triplets, seceding from that nation. At the same time, once you start jettisoning those convenient markers of self, when are you meant to stop? I suspect that you may end up finding out that these surface-level aspects are only nominally surface. Who are we to judge what defines who we really are? There's a trick to calibrating the appropriate level of change, an act that disturbs the firmament but only disturbs it. Of course, it can turn out that the things we toss away are less disposable than we assume. As if to show that it needs me no more than I need it, my old number has already been assigned to someone else. I know because another friend I hadn't seen in ages started sending a delicious volley of gossipy text messages and got a reply from a stranger politely explaining that they did not know what she was talking about. I love knowing that this stranger is out there, that maybe we've passed on the street, though hopefully not in the aisles of that organic grocery. And part of me thinks I'd know it's them. A look would pass between us, something that says, "Don't call me, I'll call you." End of article.